So welcome to the Dharma Talk. Can you all hear? Before we begin, I'd just like some translations of keywords so that you don't sit there the whole talk not knowing what I'm saying. So the first one is actually a phrase, and it's to peel back. Yeah. The next word is anonymity.
Anonymous.
Okay. And the next, cessation.
Hadila, hafsaka.
And finally, selfed. S-E-L-F-E-D. Selfed. Okay.
לעשות משהו ששייך לעצמי.
So the title is Feel the Dawn. Feel the Dawn. So recently in Australia, I was visiting one of my sons and my daughter in law in Newcastle. We have a Newcastle in Australia. And I went to an exhibition of Brett Whiteley's paintings. Brett Whiteley is a rather famous and fabulous Australian artist. The theme was water. And there were some wonderful landscape paintings. And a lot of prints that were influenced by Japanese art. But it was actually a handwritten poem in the corner of one of the paintings in very tiny writing that caught my eye. And I'm going to read you the poem. The title of the poem was Selfed in Loss. Occasionally, one wakes at 4 a.m. with the urge to drive south in the dark and feel the dawn peel back, to stop at the deserted beach and swim into the chill of anonymity. With no obligeance, no obligation to anyone or anything, selfed in loss. I'll read it one more time. Occasionally one wakes at 4 a.m. with the urge to drive south in the dark and feel the dawn peel back, to stop at the deserted beach and swim into the chill of anonymity, with no obligeance to anyone or anything, selfed in loss. So we feel the dawn peel back. And so this is the metaphor for peeling back all the layers of confusion that we experience in this life. The layers of ignorance or delusion and sorrow. It is the shedding of all that is unnecessary. All that we have built around ourselves for protection. So when we enter the retreat space, this is often the process, as we let go of layer after layer, of all that we have built around our heart to barricade it, of all that we have built to protect ourselves. So we let go of the layers of our ordinary life, our busyness, our life with its emphasis on doing something, doing this, doing that, of being somebody, our life with all the various roles we participate in. And as we sit, the layers can begin to melt away. And our roles in life can seem less significant. So what we're doing here is we're allowing ourselves to let go of all that's superficial, all that's unnecessary. It's to let go of everything that's born of habit, our habit of mind, our tendencies to behave in certain ways, our habit of identity that's based on the memory of yesterday. So our practice is one of meeting life with simplicity. To stop at a deserted beach and swim. And swim into the chill of anonymity. No one to be. For all that identifies us falls away as we swim in the great ocean. Yesterday, I was swimming in the Dead Sea, lying back, just floating. And in this experience, there's the extraordinary possibility to let go of all that we see as ourselves, to let go of the fact that I don't look great in swimmers anymore, for example, to let go of the fact that I'm a particular nationality and I'm in a foreign country, just to lie back and rest utterly and totally, letting go of being anybody. You must know this experience. It's so easy to float in the Dead Sea. And I was speaking with a young girl, smiling at the joy of swimming. And it didn't make any difference that she was Palestinian and I was Australian. We were just there in the joy of just floating, just being together, floating in the water. So please float in the water of the retreat. It's easy, just really letting go of our roles, our identities, our habits of mind, our idea of who we are, who we ought to be, what we look like, how old we are, how young we are, and so on. Letting go of all of it. Sometimes when we practice and we start to sit, we let go, but then comes a sudden kind of chill. We get frightened. There's a kind of fear that can come, a fear of the unknown. It can also be a blessed relief. On a retreat recently in Australia, a woman described to me just the falling away of everything as she sat listening in the Dharma hall. She said it was the peeling back of ordinary experience, conventional experience. And with that, she felt the precious connection with each person in the hall, just listening together. And then she said there was a tinge of fear, and her inner voice said, "But what about me? What about me?" And this is the voice of the conditioned self, the self that is familiar, entrenched, habitual, a self of memory, formed and bound in time. Some of us will be selfed in loss, as the poem says. For others, the major themes will be fear, or loneliness, or rejection, or abandonment. Or it might be superiority or arrogance. Reflect for a moment. Is the self, yourself, selfed habitually in one of these areas? So, if it is, what if we were to swim into the chill of anonymity, which means to let go of being anybody, to let go of being somebody, as Brett Whiteley, the artist and poet, did. So it requires courage to face the unknown, the new. It requires courage to see that who we ordinarily think we are is perhaps not the truth of things. It's not the actuality. The person we think we are is imagined, conditioned, embellished, imposed upon the truth of things, the truth of experience. So it is perhaps to see that this very self that I regard as me and mine is shifting, elusive, insubstantial. So the Buddha investigated this notion rather thoroughly. The realization of not-self, anatta in Pali, is part of the uniqueness of the Buddha's approach, and it's also actually one of the most difficult things to understand. So we're encouraged in the tradition to see into self and not-self. So we're encouraged to find a way of living that isn't bound A way of living that isn't bound to self-view, the narrowness and confines of the self, the view we have about who we are and how we are. So in the poem, Brett Whiteley spoke about the blessed relief of the anonymity of being free from any obligation to anyone or anything selfed in loss. So of course it struck me rather deeply that we can rather easily define ourselves through loss. It may be, of course, that we've lost someone we love. The person's in another relationship, not with us. It may be that we've lost someone through death. Many people here have. In fact, almost everybody. It may be that we've lost a child, a brother, a sister, a partner, or that we've had extraordinary financial losses that have turned our world upside down. So it's rather easy to see ourselves in relationship to loss and identify with that. A woman I met recently in Spain said to me, "I will never get over the loss of my husband." Her husband had died rather suddenly, some years before, and she still carried most of his ashes with her everywhere she went. She had given some of the ashes to some friends of hers, and the friends and I had put them in the river Ganges in Varanasi in India, but the rest she carried with her. And this view that she would never get over the death, would never get over the loss, colored her whole life, affected her entire life. It's not so unusual. She could no longer locate happiness, and the cloud of her grief obscured the sun. She was no longer happy. I know somebody whose son died, and he built a compartment in the wall of his house to put his son's ashes, because he feared that somebody would come and steal all that he had left of his son. Tragic. Because he couldn't bear the thought of being separated. Dharma teachings, of course, point to that which can never be lost. That which can never be lost. Thailand's great teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, said, "In the most fundamental sense, emptiness simply means emptiness of the attachment to me and mine." And he goes on to say that the mind will simply be a mind in its natural state. And by mind he means citta, heart mind. So the heart and mind will be a mind in its natural state, free from attachment and ignorance, because it has seen the emptiness of all things. So when one sees the emptiness of me and mine, the insubstantial nature of me and mine, the ever-changing nature of this life, when we just see that, we start to sense and know for ourselves the freedom of the heart and mind, the luminous nature of this life. And then me and mine has very little hold over us, if at all. And here I want to refer to a sutta of the Buddha's. It's called A Single Excellent Night. And it refers to, of course, the Buddha who sat under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya and had a single excellent night of liberation. And he says this, "Let not a person revive the past, or on the future build his hopes or her hopes. For the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see, let her see, each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably." So again, let's not revive the past. So this is our challenge on the retreat, because memories of the past will surely come. And sometimes we feel rather overwhelmed by memories of the past. So our challenge, and it's a discipline, we see the memory coming from the past, or on the future build his hopes. So not going too much to the future. Instead, let's see each presently arisen state. So all of the states that arise right here, right now, during the retreat. Let's take our attention there. So let's know that. And we need to know it, see into it, be with it, invincibly. So if we're invincible, we can't be overpowered. So we need to know it invincibly, unshakably. It's really something to be inspired by. Luckily, the sutta goes on and actually tells us how to do this. Because by itself, it's like, well, yes, but what do we do? This is what the Buddha says. These are the directions. One does not regard material form as self, or self as possessed of material form. Forms usually means the body, but it also means all other forms. Or material form as in self, or self as in material form. One does not regard feeling as self, perceptions as self, mental formations as self, consciousness as self, or self as possessed of consciousness, or consciousness as in self, or self as in consciousness. This is how one is invincible with regard to presently arisen states. So in other words, we're not identifying with the body and saying, this is me, this is mine, or with feelings or perceptions or mental formations or even consciousness. Or we're not saying the feeling is in me. And so on. We're simply seeing what arises, and you'll see what arises through the sensations in the body. You'll see what arises in the world of thought, and many thoughts will arise. It's not necessarily a problem. So we see the presently arisen state, we see the arising, the staying, and the passing. Thoughts arise dependent upon conditions. That's all. So we're invited not to claim them as me and mine. Not to claim the body as me and mine, or self in any way as me and mine. But this is the invitation for the retreat. So how does this work in ordinary life? So let me give you an example. In Australia, I work as a psychologist and I have a small private practice and I work rather simply from my home. My referrals usually come through doctors who refer to me. This is the system in Australia. And one day a doctor called me and she said, Radha, I really, really need a favor. I have someone I really want you to see. She said, but it's a complicated case and I won't obviously go into all the details, but the woman was suffering from depression. The complicating factor was that the person could not hear and also could not speak, which does mean it's difficult to counsel. And so the doctor said it would really, you know, help me if you could see this woman. Please, please, please see her. So I said, well, of course, but how shall we communicate? And she said, well, she can write just a little bit. She had some primary school education, she could write some notes, and she said you can actually write back to her. And in this way, we can communicate. So I said, okay, I'll give it a try, why not? The other possibility, of course, was to have an interpreter, someone who does sign language in Australia called Auslan, who could sign. And we did try that, but it didn't really work because the woman didn't feel comfortable in front of the third person. And she also felt that she was being misinterpreted in what she said. So she just wanted to come and we would sit there and write notes back and forth. So it was an interesting experience. It was extraordinary in the end. The woman was incredibly sweet. She said, I'm so lonely. No one ever talks to me. She said, I cry all the time and I just want to die. Almost, you know, heartbreaking. Heartbreaking hearing the story. So such suffering. Extraordinary suffering. So the challenge for me was how to have some kind of valuable meeting in these circumstances. So between the two of us, there was a great divide of culture, of education, of background. There was my role as a psychologist, and there was her role as the client. So there was my idea that I should somehow do something to help, and her idea that she'd come to me so that I could fix her. You know the story, if you've ever been to therapy. So I thought to myself, what crosses this divide? What can I do here? So any barrier, of course, any belief gets in the way of an authentic meeting. Of any kind of connection. So, of course, the role of psychologist had to go. It's like our thinking, isn't it? Round and round. Now round and round in the other direction. We just leave the door open and perhaps put the lights. Yes, almost. So let's go on, shall we? If we're all very still, inwardly still, the bird will settle. So back to my story. The role of psychologist needed to cease, needed to end. Because while ever that was there, there was a barrier between the two of us. And of course, those of you who work as therapists will know that there's a code of ethics. And part of the code of ethics in Australia, unfortunately, is that we're not meant to socialize or have friendships with our clients. This is not the case as a Dharma teacher, however. So I let go of the role. So when she would arrive at my door, I would hug her, kiss her, make her tea, invite her in. We would go down to the street and walk around, and I had the opportunity to discover her world and to see that it was true, that hardly anyone ever spoke to her. She couldn't hear, but she could lip-read a little bit and understand. And she knew she was really sensitized to people's energy, so she could pick up and understand what was said. So because of her deafness, she was, of course, locked in this world of isolation, of barrenness. And she was utterly delighted that we would go to a cafe together, like two really simple things that each of us in this room would do on a regular basis. Just walk down the street, look in the shops. So I would do this in the town where I lived. And then one day she brought me some photographs of her children. And then I just had an idea and I thought, oh, righto, why not? So I got out my computer and I just showed her the photographs of my children. And I showed her all the photographs of what I do in India. Me teaching and me in a sari and all of these things. And she was utterly and totally delighted. If I could have a little light, that would be great. He's come. The birds come to hear the Dharma. Thank you. One extreme to the other. So, back to my story, an interrupted story. But just in the dropping of the barriers between us, in the meeting of just one human being and another, the meeting of one heart with another, there's no self, no me, no other. Well, nothing that I could claim as self, to say it more accurately. And nothing that could be claimed as other. Just the meeting of the two. And she said, Radha, I'm so happy. All she needed was some kind of connection, some kind of meeting. And she said, I'm so happy. And then, of course, her despair was unsupported. So just in that preciousness of connection, where all barriers ceased, all roles ceased, very natural joy and happiness burst forth within her. And in that, of course, her despair was gone. Couldn't be there. She was happy. Deeply joyous and happy. Just that somebody had made the effort to find a way to communicate. And so isn't this our challenge as human beings? To find a way of crossing the gulf of all of our differences. Our differences in religion, background, beliefs, nationality, gender. To really meet one another is to find a way where the differences aren't the focus in the mind, but instead there's a very natural joy and love and delight and ease that can be discovered. And then suffering ceases. The suffering very naturally subsides. It can't be there. So the end of me and mine, the end of self and other, is the great therapy. It's the great medicine. This is the medicine of the Buddha Dharma. So to awaken is just to be at ease with the movement of the five aggregates. So if the eye rests on the body or the thoughts or the feelings, it can just rest there unproblematically without gripping anything and saying, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am. But to find a way of being rather light with ourselves, finding a lightness about ourselves, discovering that way of just floating in the Dead Sea, or Brett Whiteley swimming into the chill of anonymity. So to really understand the Dharma involves understanding this cessation, this the ending of I'm here and you're there, the ending of me and mine. Or should I say this, the ending of relating, bound to me and mine. So it's to realize the third noble truth, which is there is liberation. And so it's to be known and found by directly penetrating with awareness into the body, the feelings, the thoughts. It's to bring awareness to our ideas, concepts, constructs. And it's to realize that which isn't bound to our conditioning, isn't bound to I, me, and mine, and any thoughts about who I am or what I am. It's important that when we do this, we don't move from an understanding of self to some kind of view of not self. So we don't want to move from a view of I have a self to I don't have a self either, because that would be the view of nihilism. So when the Buddha was asked, is there a self or not, he didn't answer. So we need to be very astute and careful. We can see the deconstruction of the self. But then it's important that we don't say there is no self. It's to see that form and feelings and thoughts and views and opinions are not self instead. So as we enter and follow the Dharma path is clear and the teachings show us a really step-by-step way. And this is the way of liberation. It's the way of the heart. And the way is really, really vast. The way is vast. So may all beings feel the dawning of liberation. May all beings peel back the layers of confusion. And may all beings truly learn to meet one another with an unbarricaded heart. Thank you. Let's just sit for 2 or 3 minutes.